Welcome back to the UFO Rabbit Hole podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Chase. Today, we welcome Christopher Sharp back to the show. Chris is the founder and editor-in-chief of Liberation Times and has been one of a small handful of independent journalists who has been doggedly pursuing the UFO disclosure story over the past few years. While most of the mainstream media is asleep at the wheel, Chris has been churning out high-quality journalism, analyzing all aspects of this profound and historic story. If you aren't following Liberation Times, you absolutely should be. And I'll go a step further and recommend that if you check it out and like what you see, that you should consider becoming a patron. The work being done by independent journalists like Chris is absolutely invaluable to the disclosure effort and to bringing the facts of this case to a larger audience. And they deserve whatever support we're able to give them. I'm a patron of the Liberation Times, and for just a few bucks a month, you get to hear all the latest from Chris on the information he's hearing from his sources and the stories that he's working on before anyone else. It's a great resource, and I really can't recommend it enough. The link is in the episode description. Over the past several weeks, since the historic hearing in front of the House Oversight Subcommittee, I've seen a lot of confusion and a lot of concern in the community about the status of disclosure, with many worrying that all the momentum has been lost. The revelations by David Grush were so shocking and so incendiary that I think many have been baffled by the relative quiet that has followed. I think for those who aren't familiar with the vast complexities of how revelations like this are processed through the massive, multi-trillion-dollar organization of the U.S. government, it's easy to fear that this lull means that disclosure is dead. That's why this felt like the perfect time to bring Chris back on the show to help to frame all the latest regarding disclosure, what's going on behind the scenes, and what still might be on the horizon. Chris is working this story day in and day out, and as you'll hear directly from him, reports of the demise of disclosure have been greatly exaggerated. And before we dive into the interview, I just wanted to mention that throughout this interview with Chris, my mind kept going back to episodes 6 and 7, which focus on Tom DeLonge and the birth of the To the Stars Academy. Everything from the larger role being played by defense contractors in this push for disclosure, to the greater historical implications of non-human intelligence on this planet, to speculation about the potential involvement of entities that we once knew as the Greek gods, all come into play in this conversation. If you haven't listened to those episodes and you don't know what I'm referring to here, I'd really recommend that you do so. Now, please don't take that to mean that I'm suggesting that the origins of the UFO phenomenon has something to do with the Greek gods. I'm resolutely agnostic on all of that until more evidence becomes available. But I also want to be clear that I don't think that idea is crazy either. And whether true or not, the fact that this idea pops up so often among those connected to defense contractors, the intelligence community, and others deeply embedded in the origins of the disclosure movement, not to mention the fact that the early space program is full of missions named after these same entities, is a correlation that is worth recognizing, to say the least. It certainly indicates something, even if we aren't sure what that is. We cover a lot of ground in this interview, and I've done my best to link up sources in the episode brief so that you can follow up anything that's new to you. So without further ado, here is my interview with Chris Sharp. Chris, welcome back to the show. It's always so wonderful to have you. How have you been?
Kelly, it is such a pleasure to appear on your show. Thank you for having me on your show. Yeah, I've been fantastic. Thank you. I've had a very, very good summer. And hope you have as well. But I think things are going to get very, very interesting in the coming months when it comes to the UAP topic.
Absolutely. Well, let's just dive right into it because you are the guy. You've been, you know, working on this story nonstop. I'm sure the last few months have been absolutely wild for you. So let's start with where we're at with disclosure right now. I know some people are feeling really discouraged and like we're losing ground. And so I kind of wanted to hear from you and get your assessment of the situations. Do you feel like it's in jeopardy?
Okay, let me explain it like this. So you are an aerospace corporation. It is in your best interests to get confirmation these programs exist because you have a, let's say, an aging pool of talent working on these things. all the best young talent is going to Elon Musk and other organizations. And added on top of that, to work on these programs, let's say that you were 16 years old, you smoked marijuana, and now you're like 30 years old, you're on top of your game, you're the best engineer in the world, or best scientist in the world. Well, guess what? You're not getting on one of these programs to do with UAP, because that's how restricted these things are. So because of the restrictions involved in these programs, they can't get the best talent, basically, to look at them. And there's not enough people working on them. They could potentially be losing ground to other nations, such as China and Russia, who may have their own programs as well. So this is a really, really big problem for the contractors. And I believe that it's in their best interest to actually get acknowledgement that these exist. You know, it's like, you know, you admit they exist, give them that, give it to the public, give it to the government, give them oversight. However, in exchange, you get to open these programs up to more talent, basically. See, that's how I kind of like see it working. So what happened is in the spring, there was some intelligence authorization, that language, it came from the Senate Intelligence Committee, basically providing amnesty for aerospace corporations to get this information out. So if you're Lockheed Martin, you've been potentially running legal programs in terms of UAP, well, now you've got the golden ticket, you know, you've got amnesty. You're happy about that. However, then comes even more drastic language from the leader of the Senate, Schumer, and he's worked on this language, by the way, with the White House and other offices and agencies. So this is a really big deal. You know, you're talking about a UAP disclosure panel with 9 people elected from the president. That panel as well can create committees whereby if they wanted to, let's say, get kind of religious bodies involved, they could in terms of providing advice within some of these advisory committees. However, the kicker is for them in terms of the contractors is that the federal government would get to take eminent domain of the materials, the UAP materials, in terms of the craft and the biologics. So suddenly you're going from getting amnesty, you know, gives you an out in terms of getting your UAP programs out and confirming them. And then all of a sudden, well, actually, we're going to take possession of them in terms of the US government. So I think that may have caused some problems. But look, I see it in terms of like it's a negotiation, you know, people are setting out their stalls. And they're going to find something that can work for the White House. They're going to find something that works for the Congress. And they're going to try and work something that works for the contractors as well, hopefully. But my hope is that we can get these people in a room together in terms of the representatives from the contractors, a representative from the National Security Council, and representatives from the Congress as well, like Gang of Eight members. Basically, talk about how we get this out. You know, talk about this like adults. Because look, the one thing I don't think they factored in is that we might just have a year to get this out realistically in a controlled fashion. Because if Trump is re-elected as president, which could potentially happen next year, we just don't know. Whether you agree with Trump or not, we can all agree that he's not your average politician and he's not predictable. However, we do know that John Ratcliffe, the former DNI, has basically stated they were trying to get the UAP information out before Trump left office last time. So you could have controlled disclosure to a certain extent where you get acknowledgement next year, or you could basically not come to any agreement and then you have a Trump presidency and you could have all mayhem happening basically if he wants to get this out. So the stakes are really, really high here. And it is my hope personally that we can just get all the key people talking to each other and get something really hashed out. And let me just point out as well that the contractors, they have a lot of influence in terms of the government. You know, you're talking about a revolving door whereby, let's look at Lloyd Austin, for example, Secretary of Defense. He was a former Raytheon, for example. And let's look at Moultrie as well, Ronald Moultrie, former Patel. He was on Patel's board of advisors. So we're talking about their interest being represented in government in terms of the contractors and institutions. And also we're talking about having an immense amount of money as well. Like Lockheed, they have their own political liaison officers who will, you know, attempt to influence politics. And they also give donations to a lot of these politicians as well. So if they say no to something, if they want their interests stated firmly within the Congress and within the cabinet as well, they can definitely play their hand.
Oh, that's great insight. With all of those powers, you know, because obviously these defense contractors have a lot of lobbying power and a lot of political capital to throw around. Do you think that we should have any concerns about whether or not the Schumer legislation is actually passed with the NDAA? Are there any forces that are working against that? Or do you think at this point we have reason to be optimistic?
So what's happened within the past week is Jeremy Corbell, among some other really great advocates like Ronak, Lester, there's so many, I can't name them all. Apologies if I miss your name out, because there's so many great people. They've all basically created an advocacy campaign to actually get people calling into the offices of representatives and senators. You call on them to actually include the UAP language within the National Defense Authorization Act. So currently, you're going through conference, which is a negotiation between the key Senate committees and the key House committees. So we're talking intelligence and armed services committees. You got a situation whereby the intelligence committee within the Senate had quite comprehensive UAP language, a Schumer amendment. However, its counterpart in the House, led by the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base representative, Mike Turner, has zero zilch UAP language, and he's downplayed it in public on television. So you're talking about something here where you've got different interests at play. And it's been said to me that Mike Turner is looking to remove it, but I think it's more complex than that. I think there is an issue, perhaps with the eminent domain language. Perhaps there's some other languages there as well that might be quite controversial that contractors don't agree with. So I think there is cause for concern that it may not pass through entirely. However, I would point out that if you do get UAP language in terms of the Schumer amendment, however, it's missing a few things, let's say, like the eminent domain language, that might not be a bad thing. They'll look to come to a compromise, because if we're talking different interests, I've already stated one to contractors, you know, getting more talent in there to actually study these craft. We're also talking about oversight as well, democratic oversight, a fundamental thing for the United States and its democracy. That would be something of interest for Congress. And then also in terms of the White House and the executive and stuff, is that you can get these programs out. So basically you can cement yourselves as the biggest superpower in the world by basically having a huge program whereby you study these crafts and biologics, and you come up with like new industries, new technologies, everything basically. It will cement you as the global superpower for the next 1,000 years or something like that, you know. So there's a lot at play here. And obviously with the public, you know, the public's just interested in transparency here. So there's a lot of interest at play in terms of this. So I really, really hope there can be an agreement that suits everyone's interests here. Let's see if that happens. But I think the macro picture is that if President Trump, if they don't get something out and there's a President Trump who comes to power, I think that could be more of a risk, because then all of a sudden you may have an uncontrolled disclosure to a certain extent, you know. So I think that's really, really important to take into account. But yeah, my assessment at the moment, just based on the intuition, is that you may have UAP language included within the National Defense Authorization Act. However, it may not be as complete as it was in terms of the Schumer Amendment. However, I would suggest that people should be too downhearted if that is the case, because this is a negotiation and each side will negotiate what's in their best interests. And I think it is in everyone's best interest that we do have confirmation that these programs do exist in public, because there's a lot of stuff going on. And frankly, if it's not disclosed or confirmed that programs do exist, you could have a real crisis in terms of public trust in the government. And yeah, I do fear for that scenario.
Absolutely. Speaking of transparency, I know we had this historic hearing in the House over the summer. I think it's been a little confusing for people what has happened since then in terms of, you know, are we going to get more hearings? Was David Grush able to talk more to the members of the House who he wanted to share information with? Can you kind of just walk us through what's happened since the hearing and where we stand in terms of the House of Representatives right now?
Yeah, so you had a hearing within the Oversight Committee, within a subcommittee, within that committee. As I predicted, you know, it was dramatic. It was like a thing for the media to cover. It galvanized public interest and stuff like that. I think it did its job in terms of doing that. in terms of new hearings, so from my understanding, it's been reported that the leader of the House, Kevin McCarthy, has granted there to be more hearings, at least one new hearing, let's say, in terms of the House that could take place in terms of UAP. That's great. However, the likes of Representative Luna and Burchett, people who really led the hearing within the House in July, they really wanted a UAP select committee. However, from my understanding, that's not happened because Representative Mike Turner, the representative right past the Air Force Base, who I mentioned before, has basically said, look, you're getting into our turf here. This isn't your place to do that. So he's influenced Kevin McCarthy to decline their request to create a UAP select committee, which, yeah, that's not great. But also you're talking about a situation here whereby you need certain clearances to actually hear certain information as well. Intelligence committees and armed services committees are allowed to hear certain testimony and be briefed on certain things, whereby other committees are not allowed to. So, and that's one thing, by the way, which stops David Grush from telling them certain things within a SCIF. Even if these committees were able to get SCIFs with David Grush, unless they're on the Armed Services Committee or the Intelligence Committee, they're not able to like be briefed on certain pieces of information. So that's really, really important to consider as well when we're talking about this. But I think you could potentially expect one more hearing this year from the House Oversight Committee. I do know that there are other whistleblowers who have worked directly on these programs. So you're not talking David Grush, who knows the people on these programs. You're talking about the people he spoke to, basically, who have made official complaints to the intelligence community inspector general now. So these people come forward, and they may come forward in public as well. So potentially you could have one of those in the hearing. I don't know, but there's this whole dynamic as well with the Senate Intelligence Committee, you know, because I think it's felt by some people that if it comes from the Senate Intelligence Committee, it has more meaning because that committee has more powers to actually uncover this and to hold a church committee style hearing whereby they'll be able to uncover abuses and find out what's really going on with the UAP situation. Certain questions do need to be asked as well. I can imagine they would start off from being something like, okay, we're going to call someone from the National Reconnaissance Office in. Okay, you've got this huge budget. What exactly do you do? We know about the satellite stuff, but what do you do? Because, you know, I have it on good knowledge that the National Reconnaissance Office does look at UAP and it does study the data and stuff along with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. So I'm going off on a tangent here, but yeah, there's a lot going on at the moment, let's say. It'd be my hope though that next year within the Senate Intelligence Committee that you might get some hearings from there as well, potentially bombshell hearings. I do know that there are certain committee members like Rubio, for instance, who are really, really pushing this forward. They see this as a real platform basically to launch their own presidential ambitions as well. So yeah, there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening here at the moment. And from my understanding, there are 12 craft that are in possession of the US government. And of those 12 craft, six seem to be relatively intact and the other six aren't really much intact. And one thing I was going to mention as well was that, and this has been reported by Michael Schellenberger, by the way, a fantastic journalist. And from what he's been told as well, from what I've heard, is that sometimes these craft, they won't just be crashes. Literally, they will land, and then the US government or contracts will go over there, seeing this landed craft, and the occupants will be missing. It's quite disturbing when you think about it, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems like it could be almost a gift of some kind, right?
You got it. Yeah. Wouldn't it be interesting if you had some kind of intelligence that basically is giving technology to competing powers just to watch them kind of go off against each other? That's quite interesting, you know. And like, I think if you do look into kind of like human history, I'm going off on tangent again, but if you go look at how we think about the world, you know, even though a lot of us don't see ourselves Christian, we do live in a Christian environment by how we actually see things morally and stuff like that, which is a great thing. I think those are fundamentally like Christian like virtues, you know, like sticking up for people who are vulnerable and looking out for people in society, basically. So that's fantastic. But if you go before Christianity, you know, if you look at the Roman world, if you look in the Greek world, it was all about conquest, power, who's the strongest, stuff like that, basically, and survival of the fittest. And a lot of people have basically drawn comparisons. Well, basically, a lot of people have suggested that there's a link between these entities and the Greek gods. And in terms of, like, you know, you saying it's a gift and stuff like that, and me saying that it could be something that kind of like pits powers up against each other to see who the strongest are, I mean, it would fit within that kind of mindset, wouldn't it, really, in terms of a Greek world or Roman world?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that I like to giggle about is just how many people are going to be very upset if we do end up living in a world that looks a lot like Tom DeLonge was right about more than he was wrong. Because, you know, he was saying a lot of that stuff back in 2016 and even before 2017. And I think a lot of people have just thought that he's a little crazy. And the more we learn, the more these things do seem to align with what Tom DeLonge has been saying since the beginning, which I think a lot of people are going to have trouble swallowing that one.
Yeah, I think a lot of this, as I mentioned, in terms of, like, even if we don't think about each other as Christian, we're still in the West, at least, like, swimming in that fish tank in terms of the morals and how we navigate things and stuff like that. And I would point to one more thing as well in terms of the Enlightenment, you know, because for hundreds of years, you know, that we were very, very superstitious as a species. Even the top tiers of society, being kings and queens and people of high power and stuff like that, they were very, very superstitious. This is how a lot of our leaders thought. This is how a lot of our ancestors thought, about being superstitious and believing in gods and spirits and stuff like that. But then came the Enlightenment, and we're living in a post-Enlightenment world where we think rationally and logically and scientifically and having evidence and stuff, trusting scientific theory and stuff like that. So, you know, when it comes to this topic, you're really, really challenging just the way that we think. You're challenging the fish tank, you know, the water that we're swimming in, basically, in terms of something that predates Christianity and something that predates the Enlightenment as well. And these are kind of like building blocks, not just like our society, but the very way that we think about everything in life, basically. So this is why it's so difficult to get a handle on this topic, I feel.
Absolutely. Well, taking it back to what we were talking about with the Senate Intelligence Committee, I know that Senator Marco Rubio, back, I believe it was like at the end of June, that he did confirm on News Nation that the Senate Intelligence Committee has heard from a lot of these firsthand whistleblowers. What do you think's going on with that? It sounds like you're optimistic that hearings might be coming in the future. Do you think that they're in like an investigatory phase right now? Or what do you think they're doing with that information?
Yeah, very, very good question. So obviously the whistleblower language came out last year. That happened because the Senate Intelligence Committee was getting briefings from these whistleblowers. It didn't come from a vacuum, you know. Since then, yeah, various other whistleblowers have come forward to the Senate Intelligence Committee claiming of such programs. And they bypassed the Arrow, by the way, so the US government's UFO program. They've bypassed them because they don't trust the director. As you say, the key thing is getting verification that these do exist, because they've been given locations, they've been given program names, and all sorts of things, basically. So it's a really, really difficult thing to talk about, because there's a lot of dynamics, there's a lot of known unknowns, basically, when it comes to this, and unknown unknowns. And so that's the difficulty. We talk about legalities and stuff. Can, you know, when it comes to verification, can US government officials simply just enter a Lockheed Martin facility, for example, to verify programs if Lockheed Martin isn't going to grant them access? So you're talking about things like that, you know, and this is where it gets quite muddy, because I think there might be a game at the moment whereby Lockheed Martin, they can't legally actually admit to anything at the moment in terms of UAP until it gets that amnesty language. So you're stuck in an awkward situation. I think to a certain degree that senators have received all the verification they need in terms of this, but when it comes to 100% confirmation and verification of actually seeing the craft and stuff, I haven't received any information that's occurred yet. Doesn't mean it hasn't occurred, but I just haven't received the information that it has. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting situation. But I can imagine a situation as well whereby senators are kind of like talking to the media and the public in one way, in terms of speculating and saying, well, still looking for information, stuff like that. However, privately, different conversations are going on, and they speak about this topic in a totally different way, as if they know it's 100% true. So, yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. Speaking of David Grush, so we know that he's talked about retaliation against him, retaliation against other whistleblowers. Do you have any update on what's going on with David Grush and also specifically with the open retaliation case being overseen by the ICIG?
Yeah, so there's two complaints. There was one to the DOD Inspector General and one to the Intelligence Community Inspector General. So those are ongoing in terms of the investigations at the moment, in terms of the complaints. Officially, they've given no update in terms of what's occurring. The dynamic at play here is that the intelligence community cannot even acknowledge that Dave Grush exists and that he is a whistleblower, because Dave Grush is under whistleblower protections. So Dave Grush decides to come forward, which he has to the public. In their minds, like, cool, he can do that, but he's still in protection from us. So if he signed up to these protections, we're still not going to acknowledge him because that's part of the deal that we made. So I think they're still being investigated in terms of these threats and whatnot. I've heard nothing about that, but I will say that there's a lot of people who are getting threats. And they feel that they're being watched and stuff, and it feels quite real now. You talk to some people about it and behind the scenes, and you do see them quite worried because it does seem that they're under some kind of threat. And it's quite distressing for them and their families and stuff. And even myself, I've been told very, very openly, Chris, all your conversations that you have on your phone have been monitored. So, you know, it was quite a big wake-up call for myself. And I've decided that if I was ever to come under threat, would I still do what I'm doing? You know, I've got a young family and this is real. And I think this is a big wake-up call for people, because we're talking about something here which is more secretive and bigger than even the Manhattan Project back in the 40s, you know. We're talking about bigger secrets here. Not a very well-kept secret, but yeah. But it still is like the biggest thing in terms of a cover-up. And this isn't something that they take lightly. And there's a lot of security around this. And there's a lot of implications about this coming out in terms of legalities and stuff like that, potential mergers happening. And it does get really, really real. And it's quite scary. Some of the things I've learned about that I can't speak openly about, it's very distressing, very, very worrying. And yeah, I urge people to take caution when they're getting involved with this topic.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're very brave for doing what you're doing. I know that there's a lot of people who are dealing with that right now in our space, which is scary. It's scary stuff. And I think the scale of this is maybe hard for people to fully absorb sometimes, because like what you're talking about just a few minutes ago, we're talking about things that potentially go back to our early history. We're talking about the Enlightenment. We're not just talking about the last, you know, 80 to 100 years of our history that needs to be rewritten. We're talking about not even just the biggest secret that the American government has, but maybe the biggest secret that the human race has. And it does create danger for people. So I think people need to be aware of that, that the people who are at the forefront of this are putting themselves at risk. And I thank you for doing that. And I know you're careful and you try not to get yourself into too much trouble. But yeah, I think people need to understand that it is a risk for people.
Yeah, absolutely. You just need to take precautions when you're doing this. And the added fact for me is that I'm not a US citizen, you know, I'm a foreign citizen. And so that puts me even more in bind, you know, I'm Ross Coulthart there, I guess. And yeah, there is a bit of a fear factor. You do get concerned that, okay, if I was to go to the US one time to visit some people, will they arrest me? What happens at the airport and stuff like that? So that stuff does go through your mind sometimes. And especially when you see what happened to Gary McKinnon in the UK, you know, obviously did something that I would never dream of doing. You know, he hacked into the US government files and stuff. That was really serious. But they wanted a bit of a way for life doing that. You know, the US government did. And thankfully, they came to their senses, and the UK government and US government came to a deal basically to keep them out of jail. But look, when I'm doing this, one thing that I always make very, very clear is that, look, I cannot hear classified or confidential information.
Right.
If you want to tell me that, you go somewhere else. I do not want to hear anything that's classified. I don't want to get myself, and I don't want to get you into trouble. So that's something I always make really, really clear when I'm going about this stuff, because there are other ways that we can get information out, you know? So I always try to do my due diligence. I always try to be very, very careful when I'm getting out information.
Yeah. I always say I really want to know the answer to all of these things, but I don't want to be the first person to know or even the 100th person to know. I'm fine with finding out when everybody else finds out. That's good for me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, look, and it's not just like whistleblowers, DoD and Intel sources that like I work with, you know, like I've got a really good relationship with the DoD as well. And I speak a lot with Susan Goff, the public affairs spokesperson for UAP and Yarrow. So we have a really good relationship. Recently, she gave me information about a case over the Gulf of Mexico, which was reported at one of those hearings, whereby a test pilot is out there, sees a diamond formation on his radar over the Gulf of Mexico, goes over to see what it is. He approaches an object above the water. It's an orb object. Some sources have told me that it was docking with an object under the water, quite similar to what you had with the Tic Tac case. What happens is when this pilot approaches it, his sensors seem to be jammed. His sphere mount malfunctions, his radar goes off, and he has to like manually take a picture of this craft, basically. So we had that come out basically at the hearing in July from Representative Matt Gaetz, who was briefed on it. So last week I was officially able to confirm from the Pentagon that yes, Matt Gaetz did receive a briefing, and that they did receive a UAP report from the US Air Force out of Eglin, which is quite striking in itself, you know, because we're talking about the US Air Force that didn't really cooperate with the UAP task force and has been known for not being transparent. So now we've got on the record that the US Air Force has reported a case regarding Eglin Air Force Base, which is a really big deal. So I had that confirmed by the DoD, and also they told me that the Arrow is prioritizing that case. They're analyzing that case, and they're going to be looking to release its findings on the internet as well. So yeah, watch this space. That should be a really, really interesting one to watch. I've also been talking a lot to NORAD as well recently as well. And there's a lot going on, you know, there's a lot going on. It's never a boring day at Liberation Times, let's say.
Absolutely. Well, that definitely sounds like progress. Speaking of Arrow, it sounds like there were some shakeups with Arrow over the summer, especially since the hearing, in terms of where Arrow is reporting into now within the Pentagon. And it seems like there's maybe a little bit more directly engaged with Kirkpatrick. Can you talk a little bit about what's been going on with Arrow since the hearing?
So what happened was, like, I think there's like a misunderstanding about how this has come about. So what happened within the National Defense Authorization Act, which was passed last year by Joe Biden, within the language, they basically, so this came from the Senate and House, the language stated that it was to function underneath the Deputy of Defense, Kathleen Hicks. So she was going to have oversight of it, along with Stacey Dixon from the ODNI, the Office of National Intelligence. So that was legislated, basically, because it had been under the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security before, Ronald Moultrie, who was at one of the previous hearings. And look, his office had been known as an entity going after whistleblowers. That was the same office that went after Lou. So it's been known for persecuting whistleblowers. So, you know, in a recent article, I basically said, look, you gave oversight function for the Arrow of the worst possible place, Ronald Moultrie's office. And that was a major, major mistake. And that was actually kind of like set up by Kathleen Hicks, basically. So now what's happened, because of the lack of progress that's happened with the Arrow under Moultrie, is that the Senate has basically said, well, like, this isn't good enough. This needs to go up in the chain. This needs to be overseen by the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Kathleen Hicks, instead. So basically, it was legislated that she had to get involved, you know. This is your problem now, Kathleen Hicks. That's what the Senate and the House have said. But out came this press release a few months ago saying, Kathleen Hicks is now overseeing this. She's going to do this. She's going to make sure that it's on website. She is on the case, you know. It's kind of like it forgot the basic fact that she was told to do this by the Senate and the House. And if you go back enough, you can see that it was her who actually founded AOIMSG, which is the old name for the Arrow. And she was the one who placed it within Moultrie's office, which was a major mistake to begin with. So, You know, she's got some major work to do to regain trust, I think, and build some bridges with the UAP community when it comes to this and the US public as well. So, yeah, she's overlooking it now. She's got oversight of it. And there's also supposed to be Stacey Dixon as well from the ODNI overseeing it. But I've not got confirmation yet that she has taken that role up, but I'm looking to do so. It's very, very difficult communicating with the ODNI, unfortunately. As much flack as Susan Goff and the DOD do get in terms of communications, they are so much better than most other places. You know, if you try to talk to the Department of Energy, if you try to talk to Patel, you will not get an email back. You won't get a response. ODNI, you don't get very much information at all. So the DOD is so much better in terms of getting back to you and giving information than most other places.
Well, that's great to hear. What seems kind of interesting as we move forward with all of this is that we've gotten so few answers about, and really no answers, about that sort of weird, mysterious balloon flap that we had earlier this year back in February. Have you been hearing anything new on that, or is that just something that they've just sort of put to bed and nothing to see here, folks?
Very, very good question. Very, very good question. So, I mean, it's been told to me by various sources that the object shot down over Alaska, that was not prosaic. Something weird happened with that object. It may have jammed some sensor systems of the aircraft, and it was spherical. And one of my contributors at Liberation Times, an aerospace expert, has basically delved into this and, you know, basically suggested that it was not something prosaic. So when we're talking about that, we recently had a memo that was released by a great journalist, Daniel Otis, from the Canadian government on those instances. And it referred to that UFO as like UAP number 23 or something like that. And it was basically suggested that that was a sequencing thing, whereby it was like the 23rd, so that year to be seen over North American airspace. However, I managed to get it confirmed by NORAD that that wasn't the case at all. It was just a reference number. So by everyone just knew, okay, we're talking about object number 23. Everyone knows what we're talking about. Just something like that, basically. But it wasn't sequenced in terms of like, this is the 23rd UAP, because when it comes to NORAD, they don't even have that in their vocabulary in terms of UAP. They have unknown tracks, basically, and uncorrelated tracks and things like that. That's how they think, so they don't know. So that was really interesting. And in that memo, it talked about exploitation of an object. So I recently actually spoke to the Canadian Defence Forces about that language in terms of exploitation efforts, in terms of one of the objects. And I sent an email, and they sent me an email straight back basically saying, oh, that was about the Chinese surveillance balloon. But then I told them that the date didn't match up, because I think it was a date that matched up with the object shot down over Alaska, not the date of which they shot down the surveillance balloon. So I basically said, this isn't the Chinese surveillance balloon this member was talking about in terms of exploitation. This is another object, because it's a different date. And then they came back and they basically gave me like some answer just didn't make sense at all. And they can't, literally, they can't explain why they had that exploitation language in. I would suggest that it was just a mistake, because from talking to my sources, the Canadian government really didn't grasp what was going on in terms of NORAD and how it classifies these objects and stuff like that. So it was a really big learning curve for them. So I would suggest that basically it was a mistake in the memo in terms of that, because officially they're denying that they've actually exploited or even found anything in terms of those objects that were shot down. And that's in terms of the US government and Canadian government. And really, they can't lie. If they lie about something, that puts them in a lot of legal trouble. My best effort in terms of explaining that if something was retrieved is that the US government and the Canadian government can have plausibility in saying that we didn't recover anything. However, could have been recovered, let's say, by a private contractor. So if something was recovered, that's how they might get around it, let's say. That's how these things work, you know. Whenever I'm asking a question, I'm always thinking about, well, how are they getting around this if they have done X and Y? So that's the difficulty, you know. Like recently, I'd also point out in terms of that as well, that it was recently confirmed to me that the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office have taken possession of material of unknown origin. That was told to me by sources. And I asked the DoD, can you confirm or deny that? They can't. So I think that's very, very interesting that the DoD cannot deny that the arrow has material of unknown origin. Because before, everyone was like focused on like, well, the arrow hasn't had any material that has been of non-human origin or extraterrestrial origin. So they can confirm that. However, they can't confirm they've got nothing of unknown origin. It's very, very interesting.
That is interesting. And speaking of kind of international governments, obviously, you know, we talk a lot in terms of what's going on in the United States, but the United States doesn't own this topic. And so are you hearing anything, or do you think there's any chance that there are any international governments that could potentially start moving forward with disclosure on their own, or that could beat the U.S. to the punch in some way?
This is where the topic gets really, really complex. So previously, we've spoken about potential other UAP programs in China and Russia. And let's just say maybe it's more complex than that. Maybe there's a situation whereby the US government is working with other governments secretly that it's not supposed to be working with. And it's not traditional to work with such governments in terms of anything of this nature. So you could have an international effort happening behind the scenes in terms of retrieval, coordinating everything. So that could exist behind the scenes, basically, when we're talking about this topic. And let's not forget as well that back in 2019-18, that there was a conference, two events held by China and Russia, huge UAP events, basically, in terms of bringing the topic to the United Nations. And those happened. These are really big events. And like everyone who knows anything about China knows, this stuff doesn't get given the go-ahead unless you've got government backing. So we know there is interest in China. We know there's interest in Russia. And yeah, I think that's something very, very interesting to think about, especially if the National Defense Authorization Act doesn't go through the UAP language. I think there might be some interest there. I don't think that interest in the Chinese and the Russians have got away. And it led to the Project Titan as well, which is the project to bring the UAP before the United Nations, which is going ahead at the moment with San Marino. So that's really something interesting to take into account. I'd also point out as well that the Schumer Amendment within the Intelligence Authorization Act from the Senate also has language whereby your Secretary of State would need to coordinate with his counterparts in other countries, inquiring whether they've got their own retrieval and reverse engineering programs as well. So that's something that's like a really, really big thing that was in that language. It's like become lost, you know, because everything else is so bombshell about it. You know, that's really big. The Secretary of State would literally have to go to the Foreign Secretary in the UK and like knock on his door being like, so you guys in the UK, do you have any UAP recovery or reverse engineering programs you can tell us about? Can you start doing some investigations into those avenues? That's a big, big deal, you know. So, I hope that's not lost on everyone.
Absolutely. That's such a great point. Someone that we haven't heard a lot from recently is somebody who, in a lot of ways, kicked this whole process off, Lou Elizondo. I know that we've long been awaiting his book that is hopefully going to be coming out at some point in the future. Do you have any sense of where Lou is in kind of all of this disclosure stuff that's going on in Washington right now?
Yeah. So Lou's a really, really good friend of mine. I love him and I love his beautiful family as well. They're just amazing people. I think one thing that you get to know about Lou by knowing him is he'll never stop fighting, even if it's not in public. There's a lot he's always doing behind the scenes. And he's trying his very, very best, you know. And in terms of the book, I'm not sure where that's at the moment. I think as with anyone who used to be employed within the DoD or in the intelligence community, they'd need to go through DOPSA, you know, they'd have to have it checked and stuff like that. So I don't know if that process is happening at the moment or not, but if it is, that could take some time. And I think they'd have to think strategically about that as well, about how they go about that in terms of saying, you can talk about this, but you can't talk about that.
That was going to be my next question, is just because I was wondering if his book would have to go through that process. For listeners who might not be familiar with DOPSR, that's that clearing method through the Department of Defense that David Grush's statements had to go through, and that he's being very careful not to say anything outside of what was, you know, his DOPSR. Or even a book like Skinwalkers at the Pentagon, I believe, had to go through that process as well. So it seems like Lou Elizondo's book is most likely going through that process, it seems, right? And that could take some time.
Yeah, absolutely. So like, if I'm claiming within my book, you know, that the US has a reverse engineering program, it's all illegal, they've got non-human biologics and stuff like that, you know, I'm making these really, really big claims. And let's say that in a doctor process, someone within that program comes forward and says, you can't say that. And this is the reason why, because we're running these illegal programs. Well, guess what's happened? You got yourself in major trouble there. You've admitted that you're doing something illegal. So it's like a catch-22 in there, you know, that some people within the community can't seem to get their heads around. I think it's because a lot of those people don't really have real-world experience. And yeah, I think that's really, really important when you're going into the DOPSA process. And it's important as well to see what they can't talk about as well, what's off bounds and stuff. It certainly should be very, very interesting, let's say. And look, there's lots of things within the US government, you know, that we can talk about. Like, you know, I talked about before about the NRO, you know, and what they do. What do they do? What do the National Reconnaissance Office do, you know? And, you know, this also goes into space intelligence as well. Remember space intelligence officers. Like, that might be a big deal in the future. Space intelligence. I think there is like a really big effort behind my intuition tells me, not my sources, by the way, my intuition tells me that there is a really big effort in terms of UAP from the US government behind the scenes. Like, your government isn't stupid. My government isn't stupid. If there's stuff flying around that's more advanced than what we've got, they're not just going to ignore it. There is stuff happening behind the scenes, I believe. And I feel like, hopefully it will come out. And there might be some scary aspects about it. You know, I've got the free body problem I've been reading lately. Mm-hmm. So let's say, like, if that scenario was playing out in real life, that there was, like, something coming, which I think John Ramirez has alluded to. I think he said 2027 or something like that. Something's coming. And that's why they need to get this information out. That's a little bit scary, isn't it? So, I mean, there's both opportunity when it comes to this in terms of technology and stuff like that we've learned. But also there might be some really, really unnerving aspects to this as well, you know? I think you talk about cataclysms and stuff like that may have happened in the past. So it could be that whenever humanity rises to a certain aspect, it's put back in its cage like the gorilla that's just found the keys again. And it's been said before as well, the secrecy isn't there for us not to find out. The secrecy is there because whatever this intelligence is, we don't want it to know what we're capable of, you know? So that's another aspect to it as well. I think if you read Secret Machines, there was like the scenario given about the dogs, you know, that someone's uncle bought some dogs because they got a rat problem. The dogs did their job, got rid of the rats. And then the farmer comes back, killed all the dogs because they've done what they're supposed to do, basically. So I think that the story was put up was that when the farmer, let's say, comes back to kill the dogs, wanting to find like a Rottweiler or something like that, something that could fight back. So I don't know, like all these things, I know that my stories, you know, I have to report them matter of factly and stuff like that. And I do that so my audience can trust what I say is legitimate and stuff like that. But all these things always go through my head when I'm reporting, you know, like trying to make sense of everything and trying to kind of like connect things and stuff. So yeah, and it really helps my reporting as well. And it helps in terms of intuition and everything. So yeah.
I mean, it's hard not to start to put all of these things into context of, you know, the lore and the history. You know, there's a lot of deep, deep history here within ufology, and it's hard not to make those connections and wonder what might be true. So what are you really excited about in the next year? Like, is there anything in particular that you think we should be paying attention to? Anything that you're hoping to see in terms of disclosure over the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah. So, you know, like there's been a rumor, you know, that Kirkpatrick might not last for long in terms of the director of the Arrow. Let's see if that happens. If it does happen, are we going to get an advocate coming forward to lead that effort? My hope, and what was my assessment, and I'll stick with my assessment for now until anything changes, is that we make a confirmation next year that there is a program and that there are materials of either unknown origin or non-human origin. I think we might get confirmation perhaps next year of that. I don't know how far they go. Like, if it's conservative, they might just start with unknown origin and then later just come around and say, yeah, it's non-human origin. Or if they want to be more bold, they'll just basically go out and say that we've got this stuff and it's of non-human origin, basically. It's advanced. So I don't know. I think we could potentially get confirmation next year. We'll have to see what happens. But I think that you can watch out in terms of defense contractors having a greater role when it comes to the public conversation, perhaps. I'd also watch the Seoul Foundation as well, which is Gary Nolan's new initiative. I know he's got some other great guys behind that as well. So I think that's really, really important, because that's really going to try to bring academics into the equation as well. And it's going to look to really involve government as well in terms of this and coming up with a plan of what we should be doing and how we should be discussing this in public. So I think that's really important as well. I think when it comes to UAP, a lot of us, it's difficult enough to come to terms with the intelligence itself, whatever it may be. But when you're having this conversation for real within the halls of power and stuff like that, there's lots of legal complexities that you have to take into account, legislative implications as well. So there's a lot you have to go through, the minutiae, the boring stuff, which is also very, very crucial. And some of the practicalities about actually communicating this, you know, there's one thing communicating it to the UFO community, but how do you communicate it to the academic community and industry and stuff like that and science? So there's a lot to untangle there, you know. So I think the organizations like the Seoul Foundation play a really, really interesting role when it comes to this.
Absolutely. I'm so excited to see what they do. Well, Chris, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for coming on the show and getting us all caught up on everything going on in Washington. I'm sure I'd love to have you back, you know, in a few months, and hopefully we'll have even more exciting stuff to talk about. But thank you so much.
Let's do it. Thank you so much, Kelly. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.